Between 2002 and 2012, the number of businesses owned by Black women in America increased by 179%. Let me say that again, 179% in just 10 years. So I could imagine that some of you are wondering if maybe business ownership skyrocketed in that time period overall. And the answer is no. Overall business ownership only increased by 20%. Compare that with 179 and you're looking at a pretty remarkable difference. That's what caught the attention of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. The high growth rate for businesses owned by Black women might be instructive for all the communities out there wanting to spark growth for small businesses and local economies. But until the Fed of Kansas City came along and decided to do some research, no one had really looked at what was going on behind the numbers. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And today we're going to hear about the report on Black women's startups that the Fed put out in 2018. It's the basis for a new exhibit here in town. Del Guines is the author of the report. He's the Senior Community Development Advisor for the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, and he is based in Omaha. Del, good morning.
Good morning.
So just real quick, I want to clarify, the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City serves not just Kansas City, but an entire region. I could see that being confusing, that someone in your role is in Omaha.
Right. Yeah. Yes. We pretty much cover seven states in the Midwest. So we're Heartland Bank. You know, our president, Esther George, is from the area. And we really take regionalism seriously. So we have a branch in Omaha, Denver, and Oklahoma City. And our states cover pretty much Kansas City West, then Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, Colorado, Wyoming, and then Albuquerque North in New Mexico. So you can kind of see we're pretty much Heartland-centric.
So you conducted this original research in 2017. What exactly were you looking at, and how did you go about it?
Well, what we wanted to do is really kind of see, get behind the numbers. So when you say 179%, I think it would be helpful for the listeners to get a little bit of context. That's 1 million new businesses during that time period. And that's net. That's not gross, because, you know, businesses start and they fail during a 10-year period.
And so I want to point out the recession is during this period.
Right. Well, and in truth, that may be some of the response to the recession is, you know, often African-Americans have the highest unemployment rate, and when the economy dips, you know, you tend to see, you know, a reaction to that. And oftentimes it can be entrepreneurship. And so that's probably part of it, too. But you saw this phenomenon actually happen for women overall. Like, what people don't understand is that women overall have been seeing significant growth, but Black and Latina women specifically, you know, recently have kind of said entrepreneurship and small businesses are a thing, and are leaping into that space. So 1 million businesses during that period of time.
What were some of the findings or observations or recurring themes that interested you the most as you began to really, like, meet with the actual human beings behind these numbers?
I would just simply say how, you know, awesome these women are. Like, we've done tons of outreach, like, outside the focus groups. We've done probably 18 outreach events, both in the region and across the nation. And hearing the stories and the shared similarities, the passion, the commitment, one of the things that really struck me, and it kind of was the impetus for, you know, the Mobile Money Museum exhibit in Kansas City, was kind of this general significant sense of resiliency and grit and stick-to-itiveness, and I'm going to do this amongst this population of entrepreneurs. It's really motivating and inspiring when you get into a room of Black women entrepreneurs and just listen to their story and their tenacity. That was one of the main things that, you know, we found throughout that was a running theme. A lot of, you know, what we found was, you know, kind of challenges on the workforce, which was really interesting to me, that a lot of women had expressed that one of the primary motivations for, you know, starting a business wasn't that they didn't have a job, but that the job they have, they felt that they weren't getting the same type of opportunities, or they progressed to the level where they felt they couldn't go any further, or they just got corporate fatigue and decided to take the skills that they learned in the workforce and launch a business. So those are some of the overall headlines of the report, but it's been a really phenomenal journey for me since I started on this road.
And I want to just make sure I understand that second point, which is that what Black women in particular may find themselves up against in other workplaces where they are not the boss could be motivating
right.
them to start their own businesses.
Exactly. And I put some stories in there, some of the quotes, to kind of show that. But this is actually, if we step back, and look at like prior research, this is no surprise. Like, there's a lot of research that comes out that shows that African Americans, even if they have the same education rate, the same experience, have less opportunity in the labor market. And so with Black women, what I think we're seeing is kind of a response to that. In conjunction with some other things, there's a lot of passion for what they're trying to do. There's a lot of opportunity that they're pursuing. But when you balance those two, kind of these things that they're seeing in the labor market, probably some of the recession and the need for additional household income was really driving probably a lot of this growth, I would guess.
We are going to hear from one of the women whose stories we're talking about pretty soon, but I want to step back and look at the data because I'm reading this report on Black women who own their own businesses, and it says that the businesses started up by this particular demographic tend to be significantly smaller than the businesses owned by any other group. Can you talk to me about that, why it matters, what it might tell us?
Well, why it matters is because it's telling us that we don't have a really what we would call ecosystem or community that's situated around Black women. And this is kind of comes out in both this report and some other research that's out there. Barriers to access to capital and credit, issues like that. So what you're seeing is a lot of Black women going into these service-based industry clusters, where pretty much 68% of all Black women businesses are in three type of industries, and these industries usually don't require a lot of things the bank will want to lend against, which is like collateral. Most of them are service-based. Black women have demonstrated, at least the ones that I've had a fortunate opportunity to talk to, a significant talent of being able to conceptualize and go out and sell a business. But I think where the challenges are is we're not seeing a lot of ability to attract capital to these businesses, whether it's in the form of credit or getting money from friends and family or even kind of investment. There was
So when you say, oh yeah, go on.
yeah, go ahead. No, I was going to say there was a great report done by Digital Undivided that showed that out of all the venture capital funds in the nation, Black women get like 0.2% of that. So it's happening across all these different areas that we're seeing kind of this constrained environment that all of these women are starting businesses in.
When you talk about attracting capital, can you spell out how that works for those of us who aren't entrepreneurs and sort of like
Yeah.
why it
So,
might be?
I put it in a way most people understand. So, when you go to get a home loan, right, they're lending against your house, and they're also looking at your income and your credit score. And it's similar in a business sense. And so, the bank wants to see collateral. And most of the type of businesses that Black women are starting are businesses that have very little collateral. So, let's say that you're starting a consulting company. You're probably not going to buy a building. You're probably not going to buy equipment. You're really just leveraging, your talent, your intellectual ability, and your ability to sell. And that's hard for banks to lend against, not barring the fact that banks really don't like to lend against to startups in the first place because they're risky. And then when you look at the credit, scoring, African Americans as a whole, and this just came out in a report by the New York Fed, tend to have a lower credit score. So you start looking at those two factors, and you start seeing how there can be some challenges of accessing credit to really grow. So when we look at all of this rapid growth rate, really we have to ask ourselves what could happen if we took that same growth rate, but we really put a better environment around it where you get education, training, community support, economic support. What would happen to our economy if we could help 1 million businesses, just improve by only $10,000, for example? That's a lot of money in your economy.
Another data point that was of interest to me, businesses owned by Black women represent 59% of all Black-owned businesses, making Black women the only group of women in America with a higher share of business ownership than their male counterparts. Talk to me about that.
Right, it's a really unique phenomenon, and I'm not really sure what is happening behind it. I have some I kind of have some thoughts on it. If you start looking at educational outcomes, Black women are fastly becoming one of the rapid growing groups of highly educated individuals in the nation, and Black men are tend to be on the other side of the equation. Also, when you talk about household formation and just the fact that Black families and Black households, because of things like discrimination in the labor market or because of the lack of certain educational attributes, they need to figure out more ways to get money into the household. And some of these households are headed by women. I think some of that is driving that. So, because if you look at it, $27,000 of average revenue for a black woman on firm, that's, and most of them are part-time, that's really not going to support a household. So we're probably looking at, these women that are working, probably a full-time job, and then using, the business income to supplement the overall household income.
It seems like there would be a lot of groups who would want to look at what's up with all of these numbers because they are very striking in so many ways that you've just spelled out. It's interesting to me that, as I understand it, your research was sort of the first to actually do that.
Well, there was actually two before me. There's great research by Walker's Legacy, commissioned by the Small Business Administration, and then there was another doctoral thesis. But beyond that, that's all that we could find. And this is literally an unprecedented historical phenomena. And I could only find two people before me. And
One
so,
of them is a
what I,
doctoral thesis
right.
that
So she
like a
did
bunch
a,
of
she,
people in a university are going to read, but like its destiny is sort
Right. So only me and Walker's Legacy's research is probably readily available to the public, or the public may even have a chance of seeing. And the benefit of, working for the Federal Reserve Bank and having, our president, my bosses behind us, is that we were really able to use this to push it out there to the public in a way that for sure had never been done before, and also be able to showcase the other research that was done. And it's a challenge because you have the same phenomena happening with Latina women. Both black and Latina women produced about the same amount of businesses, but there's very little research on either of the populations. And this is something that I really feel we need to correct if we want to have a really healthy and equal economy.
Yeah, I mean, what do you make of the fact that it's such a historic development and so little research has been done?
I think some of it is because of the businesses tend to be very small, and there's a bias in entrepreneurship research and towards, kind of these high growth, I'm going to go out and get venture capital and sell my firm for $1 million or $1 billion. And it's really skewed that way. And then also, I think you can't understate the bias or potential discrimination in things like the research institutions, and this just the general lack of understanding and awareness of what's going on. Like for me, who does this for a living, right? It took me actually going out and doing a series of roundtables in the region on African American businesses and really digging into the numbers to cause me to start scratching my head and saying, "Wow, this is a tremendous trend. Why are we not talking about it?" So I think there's a couple different things going
So maybe
on.
some blind spots.
To me, it's a huge blind spot, because when we talk about the ability of entrepreneurs and small business owners to drive local economic growth, build household income, build wealth, reduce poverty, and here you have this phenomenal group of entrepreneurs and black women, and nobody's paying attention to how we can better support them. I think we all need to take a step back and look at why that's happening and how we can improve it.
Do you think that the absence of research or like a really robust public conversation about this, and it's a truly like success story, could be related to the fact that you mentioned earlier that black women seem to struggle to access capital when they set out to start businesses?
Well, I think we could have some research and institutional bias towards women in general, which has been there historically in the literature. And then when you layer on the intersectionality of race, and then maybe even some class issues, you may have some of that, within that situation too. And it's not just about capital. I mean, what we're seeing is a deficit of support in a lot of different
Give
areas.
me an example.
One of the examples is, and this was very interesting. So when we looked at, asked the women what was their greatest challenge, most people would say, "Oh, it's a lack of money." That's not what came out. What they said was it was a lack of knowledge of how to operate and start and run a business prior to when they launched. To me, that's a correct, easily correctable situation by just having more intentionally designed programs and activities that are targeting diverse populations. So you have that. You have, the issue of community support. We're in a lot of communities for entrepreneurs in general, but a lot of black women expressed they would like their community as a whole to support them more. But again, if you don't know what's happening in the marketplace or in your community, how do you know how to support it? So there's a deficit of knowledge, and we can't really expect people to take action on something they don't know is happening, which is why we came out in the first place with the report.
I'm Gina Kaufman. In just a minute, we'll be hearing from a Black woman business owner in Kansas City. She works with other women in Kansas City's entrepreneur scene. And if you are a Black woman who owns a business here in town, we want to hear from you, too. Talk to us about your experience, what's shaped it. 816-235-2888. Is there something we're missing? Help us tackle it. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've been chatting with Del Guines of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City about a report they published on businesses owned by Black women. That demographic saw a huge jump in business ownership between 2002 and 2012, bigger than the jump in all women-owned businesses and much bigger than the increase we saw for business ownership in general during that same time. But Black women still face obstacles, mostly in the form of support, as we've been hearing. Now let's hear a personal story from one of the participants in the KC Fed study. Adrian Haynes, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me this morning.
Tell me about your business, first of all. You're a lawyer and partner at Seed Law. What is Seed Law?
That's right. Seed Law celebrates 5 years this year, and we are a business law firm here in Kansas City, and we serve entrepreneurs exclusively. So we work with folks who have an idea and are thinking about starting a business, all the way up to mature companies that are looking to exit and, you know, contribute to their own generational wealth.
So you know a lot of stories of people starting businesses, but you also are a partner in a law firm, so you are the kind of business owner we're talking about as well.
That's right.
Do you relate to the overall picture Dell has painted for us, or is there something in your experience and your observations that looks kind of different up close and personal?
I would say that I deeply relate to the data that Dell has uncovered here, and I do feel like a lived example. One of the things I love is that, you know, the data shows that these are women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, women who are college educated, and those who see a need and say, hey, I think I can feel that. And many of them, and including myself, have done this by, you know, entrepreneurship by necessity. Okay, we see a need, we maybe need additional income, and we feel like we are the ones to solve the problem, which is, you know, very entrepreneurial in itself.
What do you think are the biggest challenges faced by Black women who run their own businesses or want to run their own businesses here in Kansas City, just based on what you see among your clients?
Sure. You know, I think that a lot of folks are curious about the first entry point into the entrepreneurial community. You know, I meet a lot of folks who have been working on a business, you know, at their kitchen table or running a construction company out of their truck for the last 10 years and are trying to figure out strategies to advance their business. And so I would say the silos that that can create when you wake up and you're working and you're trying to pay your people, you're going to sleep and you wake up and do the same thing. You know, sometimes there's not a lot of extra time for saying, okay, what classes can I go to? What kind of additional resources might be out there? Especially if you're what we see in the report, someone called a discouraged borrower.
What is a discouraged borrower?
You know, I would say in the report, it looks like people who maybe have told themselves no before the banks have. And I've seen a lot of that in my work too. But, you know, we have to acknowledge when we see research like this, acknowledge and strategize around systemic challenges that have been created in our country and in our communities that are perpetuated by social, political, and economic institutions. You know, and so when we talk about financial capital, that's a bank. That's policies like redlining, things that have been, you know, long practiced. And so now when Black women are creating businesses in droves and looking to kind of break out of these molds that have been created, that's what we're, I think, starting to see that tension around the growth, but maybe not adequate capital, if you will.
And that might also account for that a lot of these businesses, although the numbers of businesses are high, the businesses themselves are small.
You know, we say that, but then also in the research, we see that, I mean, it's not only firm growth, but it's firms with employees, firm sales. Those metrics are doubling and tripling. So even if they're small, I say they're still significant.
Yeah.
You know, $27,000, I'll take that. That's that's $22.50 a month. You know, that could be a new team member. That could be a new initiative. And so I think, you know, I think the best way to grow your business is to sell, create, sell, and create, you know, and sometimes I think it requires trust in order to even get equity. go ahead.
Yeah, well, what are some of the, we talked about the biggest challenges, but sure. What do you think are some of the biggest strengths and assets that people might not always see from the outside looking in?
Yeah, I would say that Dell did reiterate that, the incredible resiliency, I think, of Black women who for, I mean, centuries have had to strategize in spite of. We look at the data and we wonder why Black women are 59% of Black-owned businesses, but we fail to acknowledge the prison pipeline and the fact that a lot of Black men who are entrepreneurial and creative may be not able to, you know, really express their creativity right now.
So just acknowledging that this data not only shows success for Black women, but it might also show some obstacles, major obstacles for Black men.
Absolutely.
Tell me a little bit about yourself, because you say you feel like a lived example of this. Tell me about your upbringing and education and the adulthood you envisioned as a kid.
Sure. You know, it was, I have to first acknowledge that I saw entrepreneurship in my own home through my mom, who sold Mary Kay when I was in eighth grade. And so you
did
start
she get
to
the pink car?
No, but I do have a Cadillac today in honor of those you know, experiences back then. But, you know, I saw my mom. It was in the background, but that's important for kids to see their parents engage in entrepreneurship. And I do have to say I'm proud now that Seed Law clients, my consultancy clients, they bring their kids to the meetings. I want their kids to see entrepreneurship in action, because if you haven't seen it in your lived experiences, you may not realize that it's possible.
What do you remember about watching your mom pursue her Mary Kay sales?
Sure. Yeah, I saw her selling, which I think is important in entrepreneurship, that acknowledgement that you have the power to generate your own wealth through sales. I mean, even just acknowledging that seed can be have a powerful result. And then in high school, I got the chance to work for entrepreneurs. And I think it was really then that I said, oh, entrepreneurship is a thing. These people.
What did you do?
So it was also very strategic. I worked at a health food store and an ice cream shop. You know, both ends of the spectrum here. But I got to see, you know, young entrepreneurs who had an idea, and from idea to store open was 6 months. But I also recognized that the entrepreneur I was working for, his experience was different than any that I had seen in my family. He was a young white guy. So, you know, to be in high school, to have an idea, to get capital and start a business 6 months later, you know, you're not really, I wasn't seeing that. So I was very intrigued by that, I would say. And that really, I think, was the seed that planted my entrepreneurial career.
When did law come into the picture?
Yeah, so I was a camp director in high school and in college. Well, in college, and I was had the opportunity to work with some other entrepreneurs, but I was starting to recognize those patterns. Okay, I see the passion, I see the grit, but there's some differences between entrepreneurs who are able to formalize, scale, grow, sell, and those who might just have a side hustle. You know, that $2,700 a year that's just fueling the, you know, paying the extra bills. And so I said, okay, I'll take one for the team. I'll go to law school and help other entrepreneurs, you know, formalize their business. Because for me, it's about sustainable business and transferable wealth, which I realized over time.
It's interesting to me that you thought you could do that best as a lawyer.
Yeah. So the camp director I worked for, he would call himself a recovering attorney, but he was an attorney who was a passionate guy who went to law school, worked for a big firm so he could make enough money to start a camp. So I had seen this also example of an entrepreneurial lawyer doing something he was passionate about, which wasn't practicing law, but was, you know, I think making such a difference.
What is it about legal expertise, though, that you think can really serve an entrepreneur who is sort of in that struggling stage of, I have the idea, I have the vision, I'm not quite making that leap to reality?
Absolutely. That's a great question. And really, it goes back to those systemic disparities we were talking about. You know, if systemic disparities and these differences, the patterns I began to see in my work and in just, you know, pursuing my own passion, you know, if they're perpetuated by things like social, political, and economic institutions, and then continually enforced through norms, laws, and public policy, I realized that if I, you know, could just help stand in the gap and help people formalize, then perhaps, you know, it would be less risky.
Give me an example of how you stand in the gap. Can you give an example just from your recent experience?
Sure. So, I mean, just the very nature of formalizing your company, which we are very honored to be able to help a lot of people do. You know, the laws, when you formalize a limited liability company, it gives you the shield of limited liability, which gives you a little bit of freedom to practice your passion without feeling like you're going to risk everything.
So that's the LLC at the end of a company name. What does it actually mean?
Sure. It's a business entity structure that is set into law that says, you know, if you pursue your passions through this hybrid, through this entity, you know, you might not lose everything. So there's some parameters around your liability. And we talk about entrepreneurship as if it's very risky, which it is, but employment could be risky too. You know, you could lose your job tomorrow. So, yeah, I think entrepreneurship allows people to bet on themselves. And by helping people formalize their company, I think that allows us to acknowledge the systemic disparities, help people strategize and create around them. And then we really try to be there for our clients, you know, through their life cycle and provide that education that Dale was talking about as well.
When you work with Black women in particular who are becoming entrepreneurs or trying to take the next step as entrepreneurs, do you find that you are able to dig into your own background and story in helping to identify what kind of support they may need?
You know, a big part is just, so first, yes, because a lot of it's the silo. Okay, I've been working, raising my kids, taking care of my family, but I've been, you know, making cakes on the side or something like that, and just helping to show here are a few pathways to the resources that make up an ecosystem, which is just a, you know, systemic supports for entrepreneurs as well. But I would say that, you know, all entrepreneurs are looking for strategies to help them formalize so that it can be not as risky. And, you know, entrepreneurship, it's the business, but it's also the mentality, the grit that it requires, the stomach that it requires through the ups and the downs. But, you know, you have to have that to be an entrepreneur. We have had some great success stories in Kansas City of entrepreneurs who have made a difference, and companies that have lasted, you know, over time. H&R Block, companies like that, you know, Russell Stover's. We have Kansas City-based companies that Walt Disney, you know, that have shown the grit that it requires. And so I'm happy to be able to help Black women, you know, put their talents, connect their talents to the resources that I think are already here, including those that are within themselves.
Del Gines just told us that there were a few different industries where in America, Black women are finding a lot of success as entrepreneurs. What are the industries that you find Black women entrepreneurs gravitating toward in Kansas City?
You know, all types of industries, really. You know, we're helping people start for-profit companies. We're helping people start nonprofit entrepreneurial ventures in STEM, construction, law. I mean, it really is a wide plethora of industries. And so the interesting thing that I'll need to talk to Dell about is that the report lists other services. And so I'm wondering what some of the examples of, you know, some of those companies might be.
Dell, jump back in. What are other services?
So other services are, if you think of things like in your healthcare and, you know, social assistance, you have like your daycares. Mm-hmm. Other services are those that tend not to fit within a regularly identifiable category. They could be, you know, somebody just going out and doing a, let's say a janitorial, personal janitorial service or handyman service, which probably wouldn't fall in construction, but would fall in the other service category. And so in that category, probably more than even the others, you see less need for collateral and more just, hey, I can have my grit and my energy. I'm going to go out and start a firm is what you tend to find in that. It's kind of a catch-all category.
Adrian, does that surprise you, or you're nodding? You look very unsurprised.
Yeah, I think Black women are creating businesses in all different industries, and I think have always had a heart of service through history. And so, yeah, I'm seeing a lot of different types of ventures, I think, in the other services category as well.
You are also the head of the Multicultural Business Coalition in Kansas City, and we've heard how the numbers for business ownership among Black women stand out. But looking at multicultural business ownership on the whole in Kansas City, what do you see happening there?
You know, what I love about the Multicultural Business Coalition is we are a 501c3 nonprofit that really exists to connect some of those resource providers that make up an ecosystem. And what we realized in 2015 that we as resource partners had been operating in silos. And so our coalition is our way of linking arms and trying to really support all diverse entrepreneurship activity in Kansas City and support the leaders who are trying to create those organizations. And so I think that the trends that we're seeing is just an overall growth. But again, just I think, which is consistent with Dell's report, and a need for easy access to resources. Because I think the resources are there. But if you are head down entrepreneurship by necessity, you may not have the flexibility and the freedom to look up, especially if you're working a full-time job and trying to, you know, run your business at night and on the weekends.
Entrepreneurship by necessity is an interesting phrase.
So it's those who, you know, it could be, I'm not making any progress at work and I have these passions and I want to express them somewhere else, or I lost my job, or I'm underemployed. I see women and men actually creating businesses for all different types of reasons. But I think entrepreneurship by necessity does underscore the fact that people start businesses because they need to make money.
Yeah, and that picture that a lot of us have in our minds is that fresh out of college person with a hoodie and a dream of being a future Bill Gates.
Yeah, I'm with that too. I love wearing my hoodie at work. But more than anything, I say, I would see, even just recently, I participated in a women's event where there was a mix of both entrepreneurs and professionals. And all the women that came and talked to me were those who say, I have a full-time job. I'm thinking about starting a business. I've been holding this idea for 2, 5, 15 years. What should I do? How do I take the steps to actually make this a reality? So I would say, you know, that's the picture of what entrepreneurship looks like to me.
Let's talk to a caller. We've got Vince calling us from Waldo. Vince, what do you want to share with us?
I was commenting on the black men. You don't get to really see a lot of those relationships that are, you know, convert over to businesses that last forever. For example, listen to a lot of podcasts, and what I hear, a lot of white guys who have friends, who have uncles, who loan them money to get their business started. And so blacks have traditionally been locked out of those relationships. And so what I see a lot of as far as entrepreneurship with black men are, you know, a sole proprietor or, you know, owner operator. And when you're working your business, it's hard to run your business. So usually it runs them. So my basic comment is just relationships. I don't get to see a lot of that with black men, so that, you know, people can loan money and capital and everything else that goes along with that.
And Vince, the owner-operator model that you're talking about, the one where it's like sort of someone's just doing it alone, basically, is that something you have a lot of familiarity with?
Yes. You know, barbers, carpenters, even myself, I'm one of those. I work a full-time job, but I like entertainment. So it's been, you know, DJing and things of that nature on the side. But, you know, getting in a position to get more and more capital, it challenges, because I don't have those relationships and I'm trying to form those relationships. But at the same time, I have to maintain a 40 hour.
Well, Vince, thank you for that call. And I'd like Adrian to start with you. He's talking about social capital here. Do you find that that is an issue?
You know, what really stood out to me about his call was the fact that so many of those folks who are sole proprietors and owner operators, they still have a business that can create value. So by formalizing those businesses, that means when they, if they've been doing that for 25 years, when they're ready to be done, they may have something to sell or to transfer.
And that's the collateral piece of it that Del Gines, you were talking about before.
Right. And a point that he made, that so when we talk about black women, we're talking about a term called intersectionality. Like, you can't just reason that everything that happens to African-American people happens equally across gender, right? But what he talked about does, and in some cases it's even exacerbated for black women, because you're dealing both with the race issue and the gender issue. But the point that he made, and I think is understated when we talk about entrepreneurship, is what he calls social capital, these abilities to form networks where you build these relationships that exchange value. And discrimination is very real in those spaces, because if you think about it from a scenario where if you have a group of people that are used to doing deals on the golf course and you're never invited to the golf course because you're either African-American or African-American male or African-American female.
And maybe you didn't grow up learning golf on a golf course for the same reason.
Exactly. Like me, it would be street basketball, and I don't see too many deals, you know, happening there. But, you know, if you don't have those access to those networks, then you can't get the information. You can't build the networks, those exchange of capitals, or the buddy that's going to call the bank on your behalf and say, hey, my buddy here needs, you know, a loan for his business. You know, can you help him out? You don't get those. And that's real for a lot of minorities in America.
Adrian, jump in here.
You know, I do acknowledge the obstacles, but I think, you know, as entrepreneurs, one of the things I'm always thinking about when I hear these challenges is thinking about how do we work around that? You know, so I think about in law school how I was coming upon graduation and I said, okay, I'm going to meet with one attorney a week just to build my own network. But I will say, you know, it requires a tremendous amount of energy. And if you're working full time to create and on the side having to create to develop your own social capital, it does require a lot of energy, but it underscores the amount of grit and determination that Black women have had in growing their businesses in spite of, which, and you know, I will also just say, like, it's up to us. And so if the place where I hang out with Black women or Black women entrepreneurs is, you know, at happy hour or at the nail salon, whatever it may be, or, you know, at a networking event, I want to start talking about, you know, money there. What's going on? What's your social capital? How's your business? So I think it's also, you know, our own narrative. And I think more deals should happen on the street basketball court.
In the nail salon. Well, Adrian Haynes, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
And Del Gines, thank you.
Thank you.
Adrian is a partner at Seed Law in Kansas City. She was part of the study that the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City conducted. And right now, there's an exhibit on Black women-owned businesses at the Money Museum inside the Fed. Check it out. It's called No Turning Back. It's up through May 1st. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be switching gears when Central Standard returns. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and there's a new podcast partially created in Kansas City called Healing Masculine. It's a search, in some ways, for a healthy and flexible understanding of what masculinity is through conversations with people the host considers to be positive role models. The creator and host of that podcast is with us now. They go by the name Shim. Hi, Shim.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. I want to start by acknowledging that we're using the pronoun they. Can you talk about that a little?
Sure, absolutely. They, them is a singular use pronoun that a lot of people associate with a plural pronoun. It's also used in that way. But people use it all the time to describe someone, for instance, that they don't know. For instance, like that person over there, they are this. And so I use that pronoun because that's how I feel most comfortable being addressed.
Talk to me a little bit about your identity and how you've wrestled with masculinity yourself.
Yeah, so I identify as non-binary and trans, but the way I present to the world is I'm a tall, white, male-passing person. So to most people, they wouldn't think twice about talking to me and calling me he, for instance, right? But internally, how I feel is not identifying with a man. But I've been given this identity since childhood, right? It's instilled in our culture in so many ways and is assumed based on the way that we look to the world. So it's been a journey of reconciling that experience of maleness with learning that there were more possibilities and that those possibilities of being more gender nonconforming as those conversations have become more at the forefront of our social conversations, that those resonate more with me. And so it's just been a journey of both finding vocabulary and also finding a sense of agency within my own self-processing and reflection to describe my experience of the world and then to have a conversation with people about that as well.
Why do we need to heal masculinity, as you put it, or maybe some people might say redefine it or undefine it?
Yeah, I mean, I use the term healing because it's holistic to me. It's really up to each person, right? What your healing looks like to you in any given moment is going to be different than mine. And so in that way, I think it really frees us up to talk about masculinity in a way that is not looking for definition. Because in fact, the reason that so many people have issue with either trying to, you know, talk about masculinity from one perspective or another is generally because we're all trying to come to a consensus. And I'm not looking for a consensus here. I think that that's quite limiting. And we're in a moment of being able to choose expansion, even just looking at the they, them pronouns. That's not to limit the conversation to gender nonconforming people. It's actually to expand the conversation to gender nonconforming people, a conversation that's typically placed in a binary of male and female. You know, masculine is male and feminine is female is how we typically have this conversation. And I'm saying that we can actually begin to look at the abuse of masculinity as an energy or as a presence in our society when we talk about healing and seeing how individual healing is allows us maybe a greater scope to understand both ourselves and the experiences of other people within the parameters of what is masculine. So then comes in the secondary part is then we talk about, well, what is masculine? So it's expansive on purpose.
Tell me about the people you converse with in your podcast, because you start each episode telling the subject why you chose them and how that person shifted or expanded your understanding of what masculinity could mean. I'd like you to talk about the Kansas Cityans who made your list. Let's start with Calvin Arsenia. What was it about Calvin Arsenia that made you think this person needs to be someone I'm exploring masculinity with?
Yeah, Calvin is a beautiful example of healing masculine for me in the way that he literally presents in a way that is potentially confusing, I think, for a lot of people, but yet so acceptable because he's so soft, so nurturing, the way his voice sounds, the way his harp is played, mixed with the sensuality that he exhibits in his performances essentially across the board, and being at 6 foot tall and being a black man and being as maybe you would call it flamboyant and yet somehow very refined or maybe even, I don't know, classic in some representation. And just the nuance of that created a whole new idea of who I could be as well as someone in potentially the public eye. And that expansive opportunity that I had in a church was not something I ever anticipated. So it was so vast when I first saw him in a concert that I felt enamored with him both as a performer, but also as a representation of something more.
What came out of the conversation with him that really sticks with you?
I would say that the biggest thing is we talked about how the opposite of, I don't know, healing masculine is not a toxic masculine. The opposite of like a healthy feminine is not a toxic femininity, because so often the conversation gets pulled into this toxic place of like talking about toxic masculinity, but it's often even met with toxic femininity, you know, and there's this extreme look at how we can kind of fight the energies. I think that's it's a more common representation, and Calvin really brought that to light, that healthy femininity is also important, that it can also be toxic, and I think that really puts a cool lens on the conversation about healing masculine, because that has also been kind of confined to a toxic role. So we're trying to liberate the two, and his viewpoint on that, and mixed with his representation in the way that I said he is very soft and yet somehow refined, maybe even commanding, really resonated with me in that conversation.
Calvin, for those who don't know, is a musician in Kansas City, and he's kind of entered into the national conversation. He's a musician whose audience goes beyond Kansas City. Do you think that the fact that Calvin Arsenia is someone with an audience, with a large audience, who is putting himself out there in the pop culture realm is significant to you as far as broadening the range of what we see as masculine?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, how many harpists can you name, right?
Only
that's,
him.
That's my immediate thought is how many harpists can you name? And when you think of a harpist, who do you think of? It's not Calvin. I don't know anyone who would say, oh yeah, it's this 6'5" tall black man that dresses effeminately. You know what I mean? And sings in a really high pitched voice. It's not a typical thing. Maybe with a harpist, you don't even think of them singing. So he's already breaking so many molds at once, and also providing a brand new representation in a pop culture style. So I think it's extremely important that his music and him as a person are really put out there as viable, as something that people want. And it obviously is because of the kind of success he's having. And I think what's special about Calvin is he's very grounded. As much as he is up in the air and has this really kinetic energy, he's also very, I think, very sure in who he is, even along the process of that. And that's something I think society as a whole wants more representation for, is how can we find a way to feel comfortable in the ambiguity of this moment in time.
You know, something I want to share with you is that when Calvin came on this show to tell his story, he expressed a lot of insecurity. I mean, acknowledged it. He said, I have felt insecure about this part of myself. And you don't, I don't meet a lot of people in doing what I do who say that to an audience of thousands. And I'm curious what your thoughts are about how that relates to expanding ideas about masculinity.
Absolutely. Vulnerability is central to healing because healing implies that there's something that's been wounded. And so we cannot address healing without addressing what has been wounded. So immediately we look at, where is that wound? What is the size of that wound? You can't bandage something that you don't know like what it needs, right? If you get a cut, you know immediately you've been cut and you go to, you know, bandage it up. So there's this kind of peering into ourselves that we can do, like Calvin is doing, in a public way. We just need to find safe moments or safe vocabulary or maybe just more bravery amongst one another to host that conversation. And Calvin's providing that representation. I think that is a sense of comfort, because your insecurity does not make you uncomfortable. It just makes you human. And so when you're comfortable in the process of being human, you're more open and susceptible to allowing people into that. And then when someone identifies with that in themselves, because automatically we will, because it's something we don't have very often outside of maybe more intimate relationships, I think that really creates new pathways for conversation on a whole level.
There's a woman who participated in one of your conversations from Kansas City. She's the director of Uzazi Village, Hakima Payne. What did she teach you about masculinity? And why did she occur to you as someone who could teach you about masculinity?
Man, Hakima is an incredible human being, the founder of Uzazi Village, a Black birthing center on Troost. And just that alone is powerful. The fact that there is a birthing center on Troost, it's a Black birthing center, and it's founded by a Black woman. That especially amongst the gentrification on Troost, that immediately speaks to me as someone who's really holding power and presence. And if you go and look into her organization a little bit more, you see that she's an active participant in maternal health care and infant mortality rates nationally. And as a Black woman speaking her truth, because if you listen to her in her statements publicly, you see she doesn't hold back, as well as on her Facebook. And I think that that risks a lot. And I think that that's something that we can really take for granted for when we have people with other identities, for instance, like a white cis man, can say kind of whatever he wants, and maybe not suffer repercussions. But a Black woman, especially in the maternal health field where there's very little representation, is at a high risk, and she just doesn't care. And so that is a very masculine energy for me. And yet the concept of being in maternal and infant health is a very, you know, feminine place to be in a way. So I'm also very good friends with her. And so that's a whole other story. So we know each other intimately on that level.
But I would say that in terms of, she's pushed your own definitions and expectations around gender a lot.
I would say that I would say on an organizational level, especially. I think it's interesting to note that what's most compelling about our relationship is the receptivity to one another, to change with one another. So that's why I had her on the show too, is because I knew she would also show up, just like you mentioned, Calvin, in a very vulnerable way. And in this show, she affirmed me, and I didn't expect that, but it seemed to keep coming back to what role I had played in her life to this point in healing masculine for her. And so to feel that coming back at me from this really intense figure in our community, nationally, locally, that could not give the time of day to someone who looks like me or identifies like me, I think that that even goes beyond gender or beyond like the energetics of masculine and feminine. And it just, it hits a really deep human chord that I'm happy she brought to the show.
You are in Barcelona right now. You generally, I understand, see yourself as a nomad. And I'm curious about whether, as you travel from place to place, you see different interpretations of masculinity that inform you on your journey.
Absolutely. That's part of why I travel, because this is a global conversation. There's masculinity everywhere. There's femininity everywhere. And in order to have the most nuanced conversation that we can, that needs to include accessibility. So we're looking at access as a point of reference to different parts of the world, different cultures, different languages. So spending time in a place like Barcelona allows me to look into what is different than the US? What could we maybe interpret similarly or the like?
Just real quick, what is one thing that's different?
One thing that's different is they touch. Here they touch and it's without scarcity. There's a lot of men touching men here and that immediately sticks out to me.
Shim, creator of the Healing Masculine podcast. Our time is up, but thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Healing Masculine is a new podcast, and several of the conversations feature Kansas Cityans and their stories. That's a wrap for today's show. You can grab anything you missed at kcur.org/centralstandard. And that's also where you can find yesterday's conversation with a Kansas Cityan living in China. He shared his coronavirus diary, starting with watching the Super Bowl under partial lockdown. It was pretty interesting to hear as the U.S. and Kansas City start preparing for possibilities here. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, young voters, Democrats and Republicans, tell us about the conversations they are having and the issues that matter to them. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.